This is an ABC podcast.
Hello once more. Take a step into the minefield. We try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-tiptoer. Is that... I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what I'm doing, Scott. Apologies for that. But anyway, that was the best I could muster.
That's great. Hey, can I ask you two quick questions?
Yes.
So firstly, may I remind our audience what's coming up at the beginning of May?
That's what I was going to do. I'm glad you're doing this. Go for it.
So look, just a little forward announcement that first show of May, we are going to be stepping back into the wonderful world of the Minefield, Not Quite a Book Club. This time, our topic for your attention and enjoyment, our object lesson, is Harold Ramis's 1993 masterpiece, Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. It's rich, fertile territory for all sorts of glorious reflection and moral speculation and, let's just say, outright betterment. Okay. It's a wonderful movie that conceals remarkable philosophical depth, and it's just a fun watch. So if you want to really participate in the conversation, if you want to lean right into it, then please avail yourself of the 141 minutes it will take for you to watch.
Minus credits.
minus credits. It's true. It's true.
Yeah, and you might even be able to fast forward through the opening sequence of Clouds if you're really, really pressed.
Except the clouds are important.
No, I don't dispute that.
Come on.
I'm just thinking about the contemporary age, Scott.
Oh, my Lord. Second question. So you say every week, the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life.
Yeah.
How do you understand the difference between those two things?
Between ethics and morality?
Yeah. Or the ethical and the moral, let's just put it that way.
I mean, you're putting me in a bind here because I'm just reading out a sentence that I think you wrote at some point 10 years ago. And we've done whole years where I've tried to come up with something else to say. And unfortunately, because when I think about it, it's usually as I'm about to say it, yeah. I don't come up with anything good. I would just, this is riffing now, Scott, so
please,
yeah. Don't expect there to be pearls here.
Well, you're at your best when you riff. That's
no, that's not always true. Well, if it is, it's an indictment. I would say that the moral is a fuller concept. So when I think of what's ethical, maybe I can come up with a, imagine three concentric circles,
sure.
Each inside the other, where there is the legal,
mm-hmm. Nice.
There is the ethical. And then there is the moral.
Whew. Okay.
And I would say that the moral, being the most expansive, is that which has the richest range of considerations within it.
Hmm.
The legal is constrained. This is actually where we're going to end up today, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
There is only so much ethical and moral work the legal can do.
That's right.
Ethics. So ethics is complicated for me because the first thing I think of with ethics is ethical obligations that pertain to a profession,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For example. So if you, and to use the example I know, when you become admitted to the legal profession, you take on certain ethical obligations that involve the duties that you owe, for example, to the court, to the client, how those things are ranked, so on and so forth, the way in which you run cases or handle money or all these sorts of things. So these are broadly called legal ethics or professional ethics, and every profession would have them. The medical profession would have them, for example. One of the reasons I think we can say that journalism is not a profession is that journalism doesn't have that. It has a code that is there, but it's not an enforceable ethical framework in the way that you have in the traditional professions where you can be disbarred and so on and so forth. So that's kind of where my mind goes immediately when I think about what is ethical. It's broader than the legal, although in the cases I'm talking about, there are, I suppose, quasi or even legal consequences. But it doesn't go quite as far as the moral, which is about recognizing something that is richer and perhaps even seeking something that is purer or more purifying.
Isn't that interesting? On one level, conceptually, I agree with just about everything that you've just said, and also the way that you kind of tease things out.
Did you like the concentric circle, Scott?
Yes, but I would probably invert it.
Ah, you think ethics is broader than morality?
So every profession has a form of ethics that is inherent to it, that is particular to it. So what it means, for instance, to practice the law ethically, what it means to practice journalism ethically, what it means, for instance, to be a politician ethically, to practice representative politics ethically. They're all forms of ethics that pertain to each one of those particular practices, vocations, disciplines. Ordinarily, they would first be articulated in the form of a code. But for really serious professions, professions that have a sense of their own history, of their tradition, but also that take themselves seriously as a discipline that requires those who subscribe to them, who find a place within them, to rise to their challenge, to rise to meet them rather than simply accommodate themselves to wherever their employees find themselves. Then you have the various forms of censure, of discipline, of consequence when those ethical breaches happen. I mean, there are forms of ethical breaches that can overtake a journalist. Very important ones.
Yeah, but not in
the same as the sense of, say, the law or medical practice.
Not in any sort of enforceable way.
No, possibly not.
So no one who becomes a journalist gets admitted into the profession.
Yes.
And then, as a result of that, takes upon themselves certain binding ethical obligations.
Okay, terrific. So what's interesting here, though, is that each one of those forms of ethics that are particular to the various disciplines, the various vocations that we're talking about, you could say that each one of those forms of ethics derive from certain fundamental principles. There might be fairness and fair dealing. There might be non-partiality. So there are all sorts of things where you could see, say, a degree of commonality, suggesting that behind the practices, the ethical practices that are particular to each one of these vocations, there are a common series of, let's call them, ethical principles that undergird them. So while they might take a particular form, if you're a journalist, if you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, nonetheless, you can kind of trace the threads back to something, a shared set of principles that undergirds them all. Whereas it seems to me that the moral, I think on one level, this is the paradox, isn't it? On one level, the moral is, you're right, something bigger, something broader, something that is more overarching and that demands a degree of, and I like the way that you use the term almost purity. I think that's right.
Can I think I've distilled a little better.
Okay.
Morality goes to the soul.
Okay.
Ethics
Here we go.
Goes to conduct.
All right. Now, here's where I think, yes, but there's also a slight difference because where I would invert your concentric circles is the moral is that which cares for, is that which superintends the spaces in between us. So there—
But also above us.
Yes. In other words, the moral is inherently a form of relationality. There are forms of obligation that the existence of the other imposes upon us.
Okay, I know what you're saying. But I don't want to make it mere relationality.
No. I understand. This is probably a slight difference between us. So here's where, if you think about the ethical as the broad concept, the broad overarching framework, then you can have species of the ethical. And you could have the species of the ethical within the law, within journalism, within politics, within the family even. And here we would say that morality is a kind of species of the ethical that superintends our obligations to one another and our recognition of what is most demanding upon us and what is of greatest value.
Yeah, I'd say I wouldn't frame it that way because I think it's possible to be a morally retrograde character who nonetheless observes
the rules,
the ethical constraints of a profession, for example.
That's probably right.
So that's why I find it a broader concept.
So you can be a good doctor and not necessarily a good person.
Be an ethical doctor.
You can be an ethical doctor and not necessarily
I know this is a line I cannot cross, but that doesn't mean that I don't have all these sort of moral problems.
Yeah.
Character defects and so on. So I'd kind of regard the moral as more demanding.
Whew. All right.
In that way.
Excellent.
Would you disagree with that?
No, I would not.
Okay. Now, the audience will have no idea how this relates to the topic, but I think we've walked almost into the center of the
Yes,
topic
we have. That's today. The whole point.
Go on.
So what are we talking about? Are we talking about the ethics of journalism? Are we talking about the ethics inherent to law? There's been a really interesting coincidence, a convergence of events.
Would you say a spate?
A spate, yeah. I like convergence because these things have kind of unexpectedly come together. And by coming together, there are some interrelations that have revealed themselves that have made it, to my mind, almost unavoidable that we had to talk about them. So on Monday, the 15th of April, the federal court Justice Michael Lee delivered his judgment in the defamation action brought by Bruce Lehrman.
Actually, I should just acknowledge for those who may not know, just for the purposes of being completely upfront, I, of course, am a little bit compromised in this, aren't I? Because I am an employee, not just of Network 10, which was a party to the defamation proceedings, but of the specific program that was involved in that story. I myself wasn't involved in that story, but nonetheless, the connection is there. I declare that. You can do what you like with that information. Whether you think it infects what I'm saying or not is entirely up to you, and I'll do my best to proceed in a way that does service to the issue.
Anybody who's been following the news for the last 3 years, really, will know about this case involving Bruce Lehrman and Brittany Higgins. We've touched on this case very briefly in a prior show. And one of the things that we identified, I think, at that time, this is right back in late 2021, early 2022, is that in 2021, it's almost as if Australia and Australian politics underwent a highly compressed, severely intensified Me Too moment. There was a convergence of events. There was a series of allegations that were made against men with power, men in power, that resonated to an extraordinary degree with many Australian women, that resonated with some of the concerns about the lack of justice, about the lack of transparency, about the lack of accountability that were being voiced by people overseas. It all took place in a very, very intense time. Where the Lehrman-Higgins case, I think, has been different from just about anything else that we've seen anywhere else in the world, with the possible exception of the Harvey Weinstein prosecutions, and there have been multiple, is that this particular case gave rise to not just a series of legal proceedings. Annabelle Crabb, in a wonderful recent piece, described it as almost vine-like in the way that it spread and shot out its tendrils and caught up various people and various professions in such a way that they couldn't quite extricate themselves from it. But also the two figures at the center of it, Brittany Higgins and Bruce Lehrman, became standards, became representative figures around which different teams, different sides, different tribes aligned themselves. And then in the middle of all that, you have the role that the media played in prosecuting one side of the case or advancing the other. And I think what was interesting in that respect, and this is where it's kind of different with what's been going on overseas, is that here we had legal proceedings overlapping to a substantial degree with a certain degree of media coverage. That meant that the one, let's just say, complicated the other due to the temporal overlap.
Also, legal proceedings overlapping each other.
There are still other
legal proceedings to take place here.
And I think what was interesting in the way that so many of the Me Too allegations were covered overseas, for instance, is that because of the long time that it was taken for these things to go to court, the only justice that a great many victims, a great many of those who were bringing allegations into public, the only justice that many of them could be assured of or could hope for was the justice that can be dealt in the public square itself. And so here, through this convergence, through this overlap of law and media, the media doing the things that it does, and we might want to talk about that a little bit later, and the law doing that which it does, which is giving very careful attention to due process, and I'll just quote the words of Federal Court Justice Michael Lee. He said that one of the things, unfortunately, that was a casualty in the Lehrman-Higgins case is the fair and orderly progress of the underlying allegation of sexual assault proceeding through the criminal justice system. That's what the law, that's what the courts can guarantee. The media is interested in something subtly, importantly, I think for our purposes, different. So that happened on the 15th of April. On the 11th of April, we received news, it became public, that O.J. Simpson died at the age of 76. So 10 years ago, Simpson, one of the greatest running backs in NFL history, one of the most accomplished American sportsmen, was accused of the murders.
Sorry, and then a popular actor.
And then a very popular actor. He was one of the most broadly popular, I mean, the only real analog to someone like O.J. Simpson would be someone like Bill Cosby, possibly even someone like Michael Jackson, figures around whom a very, very, very broad audience could gather and find a degree of enjoyment. Anyway, in 1994, exactly 30 years ago, Simpson was accused of the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman. In the 16 months that followed his arrest, his being charged, there was a seven-month delay before the beginning of a nine-month trial, which at the time, and just remember, Willie, this is pre-internet. I mean, quite stunningly pre-internet. Over 9 months, there was wall-to-wall coverage on all the major television networks, on all the then-existing cable news channels. There was wall-to-wall coverage of what was then being described as the trial of the century. Everything was involved in this trial. There was the salaciousness of it. There was the scandal and the spectacle of it. There was the bloodiness of the crimes themselves. There were the high-profile lawyers that were enlisted, chief among them Johnny Cochran, one of the great civil rights lawyers of the 1970s and 80s, who himself had been so spectacularly involved in the prosecution of policemen who were implicated in or charged with police brutality against African Americans. So many things. This is 3 years after the Rodney King beating. This is 2 years after the four men who subjected Rodney King to that horrendous beating that was caught on film were acquitted of their crimes. This is within living memory of the Watts riots that raged in Los Angeles. This is at one of the low points of public confidence in the Los Angeles Police Department. And all of these things, America's racial history, the spectacle of the relationship between a celebrity, I mean, one of the really great celebrities of the moment, and his marriage to a relationship with a much younger white woman. All of these things converged around this case. And very quickly, it became clear that this case was not really about the murder. It was about faith in the legal system. It was a referendum on the Los Angeles Police Department. Everything is there.
In other words, the things that are common in these cases, actually, there are two things common. One is that the accused in this case has no criminal finding against them.
That's right.
But does have a civil finding.
Yes, that's true. That is true.
Right? So yeah. That is now the case with Bruce Lemon, and it was the case with O.J. Simpson, where he was found liable for the deaths, and he had to pay 30-odd million in compensation, something
yep.
like that.
33.
It puts both the accused in these cases in a weird limbo land where you can assert, you can say, state as a fact that a court has found them to have done X, but they have not been found guilty of X in a criminal jurisdiction. This doesn't happen that often, I don't think. Certainly not publicly. There aren't many people in that sort of scenario. So that's one commonality. But the other commonality, which is the one that you're drawing out, is these cases are ostensibly and on paper about what you might call private allegations and disputes, right? A criminal allegation, X did this to Y, whether Y be me or whether Y be a now deceased person, or a civil proceeding. You defamed me, or you were negligent and you are now liable because of your conduct that led to the deaths of... But these cases become political avatars. And so to understand them as the public and certainly as the media understands them... And here, when I say media, I want to be clear, I'm not talking about the media involved in the specific cases.
No.
So in Lerman's case, I'm talking about the whole media culture that surrounds these events. As far as they're concerned, this isn't a case. This is a cause. The court here becomes the forum for the prosecution and the observation of politics.
Yes. Can I just read you? There was a civil rights activist who was very closely involved with the, let's say, outward-facing dimension of the O.J. Simpson case. His name is Danny Bakewell, a very, very well-known civil rights activist in Los Angeles. Here's what he said about O.J. Simpson. He said, Simpson was a vessel. He was simply a tool that allowed something to come out and be exposed. To some extent, that I think, unless the media becomes wholly involved with, say, the tawdry details of a particular case, the other tendency that the media generally tends to indulge in, and this is, I think, what's going on when you referred to this not as a case but a cause, is that this particular allegation becomes a vessel, it becomes a tool, it becomes a vehicle through which people not connected to the case in any way can...
Well, no, you can't say not in any way. In any direct way.
In any direct way. I beg your pardon. Yes, you're right.
Yep.
But can find a degree of identification. If this person goes free, I will feel as if something precious has been ripped away from
me. Yeah, so in other words, this person is no longer themselves as a person. They stand in for an archetype.
Precisely right.
For a type of person.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, I know there's another case in this convergence.
Yeah. This is, in some respects, it's going to be a consequential one. It's very, very different. This is the case that has just gotten underway in the District Court of Manhattan on the 15th of April in the so-called hush money case against former president and current Republican candidate Donald Trump.
The first actual moment of a criminal proceeding being brought against him.
Yes.
It feels like this has happened 1,000 times before. It hasn't.
This is actually the first time. All of the other cases have been delayed for various reasons. And I think, again, what's interesting here, Waleed, is that there are particular details that are salient to this particular case. And there is the potential of there being a legal flimsiness at the heart of the case because of the way in which certain charges are connected with other charges that then raise them to the level of a felony. Now, what's interesting about this is that for many people, why the Trump case is seismic is because on the one hand, what's really at stake here is the principle of everyone being equal before the law. If a powerful man and a former president gets preferential treatment, what does this say about the status of the law in an advanced democracy like the United States? But it's also, this is an opportunity for a man who in the minds of many has been guilty of egregious crimes. Before being president, while president, and after the presidency, this is an opportunity for him to be held to account. For others still, it's the future of democracy that is on trial or that hangs in the balance. And the reason that I'm putting this together with the other two is that for many people, if this case falls over, if a jury acquits Donald Trump of the charges that have been laid against him, for many, this will be a condemnation of the judicial system. This will be a profound injustice that is being done, not so much to Donald Trump, but for other people who are worried about the integrity of representative politics. This is the thread that connects all three. In all three instances, there are the specifics that have to do with a particular case. But then there's the representative quality of that case, the extent to which there are other people who are tuning into it who feel deeply connected to it and will feel that a grave injustice will have been done to them if a particular outcome doesn't follow, and who in turn will feel themselves validated, justified, relieved, upheld if a particular verdict comes down that they wouldn't have felt otherwise. And here you just need to think, I think, there is of course another thread, which is that all three of these cases severely divided the publics who viewed them.
Well, precisely because of their political nature.
That's right. And there you have, I think, the really remarkable spectacle, and it was a spectacle, of the divided audiences after the OJ verdict.
The surveyed responses. I mean, if you asked black Americans whether they thought he was guilty or not, and white Americans, it was as polarized as you could get.
It could not have been more. And for an entire group of people, this was justice done, and this was a condemnation of the LAPD. For a group of other people, this is an egregious miscarriage of justice.
I think the point is actually illustrated most clearly in the Trump case.
Hmm.
Because in the Lehrman case, you're talking about an allegation of rape. In the O.J. Simpson case, you're talking about allegation of murder. These are, whatever else you want to say about the political movements, causes, concerns that attach to them, these are very serious allegations of very serious crimes.
Mm.
In the Donald Trump case, it's really a matter of the characterization of a payment and whether it violates particular elements of
electoral law.
Electoral law.
Mm, that's right.
Which I'm not saying they're insignificant. I think electoral law is important in a democracy. Sure. We're not talking about murder here. We're not talking about something that, absent the figure of Donald Trump stepping into this, would have set passions alight. And I could easily imagine another scenario with a candidate or a former president who is nowhere near as incendiary, where people would regard this as a bit of a technical excursion.
Mm-hmm.
But no one who is opposed to Donald Trump seems to be arguing that in this case. And that, I think, underscores the representative nature of it, really. It's as though Trump isn't on trial for his characterization of a payment. Trump is on trial for his entire body of work of malfeasance. You know, his contempt for democracy generally, his contempt for the law,
for
so
the truth,
and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, all these sorts of things, which is, of course, not what the case is actually about when understood on its own terms. And it's that phrase, I think, that sets up this phenomenon that we're observing, on its own terms. When the law engages with something, it does so with a narrow scope, with careful attention to the minutiae of the facts and the evidence in a particular case, in order to reach a verdict that is good for that particular case and that factual scenario and no other, subject to the establishment of principles of precedent. But
yes, but may I also suggest that in its very fidelity to the particularities of that case, the law thereby expresses its own fidelity to a set of ethical commitments that are inherent to the practice of law as such.
Yes, and those ethical commitments have to be, to some extent, I don't want to overstate this because I don't want to make it sound like this is purely a liberal position, because it's not, but it has to be concerned to a large degree with the rights of the individual claimants, respondents, prosecutors, defendants in each case, rather than in broader arguments about what constitutes capital J justice in a political sense.
Yes.
In other words, the law, ideally, should have no regard to whether or not police have been killing black people with impunity in deciding the specific question of whether or not O.J. Simpson was guilty of murder. That's the inquiry and the task of the law in that particular case.
Yes.
Right? Where this becomes a problem, where you start to see the pyrotechnics in the way that we have been, and I think you start to see things rub up against each other in ways that I don't think have been especially edifying in most of these situations, is where the law is being used with its concerns, its focus, its apparatus, its approach is being used to try to achieve an outcome that it is not suited for, right? Where the apparatus of the law is not the apparatus to achieve the kind of political change you're talking about. There are cases where they align. You might talk about, I don't know, Brown and Board of Education, or, you know, various civil rights cases that we've seen in America. You might even talk about something like Mabo or Wick or something like that in Australia. But these are very rare, and they usually concern questions where the court is considering something that becomes inherently political in nature, but not the kind of, for want of a better term, private proceedings, even though criminal proceedings are never really private, but you know what I mean? And when that happens, I think you can do damage. You can certainly do damage to the law. One of the things that's been so interesting, I think, has been to see the way in which the law has emerged, and particularly in the Lehman case, the admiration for Justice Lee is extraordinary. And it seems more or less universal. And I would also say there was a little bit of that going around in the judgment against Cardinal Pell, even though that was overturned.
I agree.
There was a huge amount of admiration for the way in which the judge went through it all. In other words, people saw the legal process and they saw legal reasoning in action and they actually liked it.
And they also saw the virtues that are inherent to that. And can I identify just one thing in particular? I mean, in Justice Lee's judgment, what was really remarkable is the extent to which it showcased what the law can do in its particular approach to fact-finding or adjudicating on the balance of probabilities. It also demonstrated, if I can just put it this way, a form of ethical reasoning that is comfortable with or that is unwilling to shy away from gray areas, compromised evidence. There was a dignity to his entire approach and the way in which, even when he issued something like a fairly unflattering judgment of the conduct or the testimony of one actor or another,
it nonetheless upheld the dignity and the peculiarity of the claim of that particular actor. And there's something here, Willie, that I do think a word needs to be said for the importance of the media in some of these cases. We can get to that in a second, but there's this moment. It's one of those things that's kind of seared into my mind. Helen Garner's book, This House of Grief, it's her account of the trial of Robert Farquharson, who 2005, 2006, was tried for the murder of his three sons in a terrible, terrible car accident. After the evidence has been given, so Helen Garner is in the courtroom. She's listened to the entire thing. This variously kind of tragic and pathetic and loathsome character has been in front of her this entire time. And all the evidence has been heard. The jury has been dismissed. And Justice Cummins, who presided over the case, addresses Mr. Farquharson. The wait for the verdict, he said, is the hardest part of the trial. I suggest you try to bear up. It's that moment of tenderness within judicial proceedings that highlights, I think, one of the things that is at the center of the ethical commitments that are inherent to the law as such. There's no finding of monstrousness, let's put it that way. There's a tenderness and a cautiousness that is inherent to the process itself. And if we lose that in the face of kind of vast capital C causes, I think something dramatic, something precious in our common life is being lost.
All true, but there is also a preparedness to depart from anyone's narrative.
That's right.
And
yes.
That's the thing. So that's what happens when you have cases turned into causes, is that the analysis of the case must adhere to a whole superstructure of ideas, conclusions, and convictions. What the law is ultimately able to do is say, that conviction is supported and justified, that one is not.
Hmm.
And so in that way, it sort of dissolves...
It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Right. Hmm. And it dissolves the certainty, sometimes the stultifying or suffocating certainty, of the political narrative that attaches with attention to the particularity. Now, that might mean there are unsatisfactory results at the political level in some cases, and there are lots of examples of judges doing that. Mm-hmm. So I don't like this result, but this is the result, right? This is what the law binds, or this is what the law requires. And if you want to change that, that's for Parliament, or it's a political process. So it doesn't necessarily solve those problems, but there is something that it offers. It also perhaps illustrates why it's often not a forum that is ideal for the prosecution of broader political claims. Anyway.
And this also may really raise all sorts of questions about the publicization, the broadcasting of legal proceedings.
Let's get to a guest, shall we?
Our guest is Sasha Molitoris. He's senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at UTS, where he works conveniently enough for us on the intersection of media and law. Sasha, thank you so much for joining us on The Minefield.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Waleed. Happy to be here.
So where do you want to take the conversation?
Oh, that's a good question. So many points to pick up. I guess to go right back to the beginning with that conversation about moral and ethical, maybe I could complicate things a bit more. To me, I use those terms interchangeably. I think, you know, talking to students and trying to it's complicated enough trying to teach what one of those terms encompasses, ethics or morality. But I do like that idea of purity that you brought in there, Waleed, as well. There is something that transcends a lot of basic ways that we interact and wants us to be better. And I love that idea of the concentric circles and positing the legal at the center as the smallest of those. But I'd also maybe challenge that too. An example that a colleague of mine in the law faculty gave recently was talking about intellectual property. And this was a little while ago during COVID, coming up with vaccines where big companies were protecting their IP in some of these new vaccines. And the result was that a lot of people were dying in some poorer countries. So we can argue about the ethics of that, because the companies, of course, would argue they need to protect their IP so that they can fund their research and come up with better solutions. But arguably, it's IP and the law that are protecting something that is unethical. Certainly that's arguable. So there is, to me, it's unfortunately perhaps more complicated. Hopefully the law and ethics overlap and they are concentric circles, but I think sometimes it's a little bit more complicated than that. And then I guess just to bring it back to, you know, all those fascinating cases that we're talking about. I mean, to me, we're talking about journalism and the law and how they intersect and their different approaches. And fundamentally, I think they have the same objective, right? They're trying to arrive at the truth. That's what journalism is trying to do.
I don't know about that, actually.
Well, that's a big claim, right? But
you know what's really interesting, actually? This might surprise you. I think that is a truer claim of journalism than it is of the law.
That does surprise me.
It does, yeah. I understand that. We're fully aware that's counterintuitive. The law isn't necessarily trying to arrive at the truth, I think. What the law is trying to do is administer justice.
Okay.
There are times where justice may run counter to the truth. Think, for example, of cases that are thrown out because the evidence that absolutely seals the case is illegally obtained. Think of the things that might compromise the collection of truth. That could be right to silence or the fact that an accused doesn't need to be cross-examined. They can just simply sit there and they don't have to put in a positive account of what happened in any situation. That would journalistically be suspect, wouldn't it? Because you would say, well, now we're not getting the full story. Or we might say, does it really matter how the show obtained this footage if what it shows is the truth and that truth is really important? Now, that's not to say that journalism is always better at getting to the truth than the courts. I think you could run a very strong argument that the opposite is true.
That's right.
But I think it's an important point to note conceptually that the search for truth is not actually the primary purpose of justice. It's something that goes along in the process of administering justice, but they're not coextensive and they're not quite the same thing.
That's a very good point, and I stand corrected. Maybe I could qualify that claim that the law has as its aim to arrive at the truth in the pursuit of justice. Or, no, that's not quite expressed right, but using the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure that are in place in order to reach the verdict that is required for justice. So, you know, I'm thinking here in terms of the cases that we're talking about, and I guess most obviously and recently the Lerman case here, but, you know, the rules of evidence, standards of proof that received such an airing, you know, talking about the balance of probabilities and what that means. And you were talking earlier about, you know, the fascinating aspect of these cases that these people have been found guilty to a civil standard, but not to a criminal standard. What does that mean? They're in this weird sort of limbo. Also, there was Justice Lee reopening the case to hear more evidence. So fundamentally, it did strike me as a really impressive judgment, as it struck a lot of people, the judgment in the Lerman case. And a lot of that came down to this forensic attention to trying to get to the bottom of what happened on that night in March 2019 in the early hours. And, you know, so fundamentally, yes, this is about the pursuit of justice, but it's about coming to some sort of truth by weighing up all the evidence. And I think that's what journalism does too. And both the law and journalism have flaws in their process, in the way that they work. And you mentioned with journalism that lack of a coherent code and a binding code and the enforceability of penalties when journalists stuff up, when they act unethically. You know, of course, there are...
And probably for very good reason, by the way. I'm not spruiking for something like that, because it raises all sorts of free speech issues in a democracy.
Very true. There's a real tension there. And there are some penalties and there is some enforcement. You know, broadcasters can have their licenses taken away at the very extreme end, or sanctions can be, you know, journalists can be disciplined internally, or, you know, we see transgressions by journalists that then do have penalties imposed. One of the real problems with journalism, I think, in Australia is that we have this real inconsistency and incoherence with the oversight of journalism. And so we have, you know, by our count at UTS, at the Centre for Media Transition, we've counted 14 codes and standards, you know, from the Commercial TV Industry Code of Practice to the Media Entertainment and Arts Alliance Code for Journalists, which was discussed in the Lerman trial, to the APC, the Australian Press Council. So we have all these different codes and standards. They have different provisions. You know, so disclosure was very relevant here. If we're talking about Spotlight, their payments and the benefits that they gave to Lerman in securing the interview, what do these codes say about those disclosures? And when you have a bit of a look, they're very inconsistent. So journalists do operate under all sorts of different rules. Their enforcement is really patchy. And I guess the larger
question...
And
often voluntary. That's the other...
Often voluntary, absolutely. Yeah. And
which
as
is
you
the
say,
difference.
As you say, well, you know, what do we want in terms of our journalists as well? You know, what sort of codes do we want them to be bound to? And what sort of freedom of speech do we want to allow?
As the most legally illiterate person in this particular conversation, let me take a slight pivot here. Because there's something else that's been going on here that's been variously worrying and interesting me. The media does certain things, and it is equipped to do certain things with certain highly particularistic stories. So, for instance, in the example of a terrible, say, helicopter accident, this really can't be covered as a kind of freak accident, but rather something that is meant to hold you for a time that then raises broader concerns about regulatory slackness, about the possibility, likelihood of other such instances. When it is, say, an example of police brutality, of racial injustice, of sexual violence, in each instance, the media handles these and can only handle these, I think, in a particular way. And that is not as a particular example of something, but rather, is this about dot, dot, dot? So, for instance, in the wake of the recent stabbings at Bondi Shopping Center, was this about violence against and the targeting of women? In the example of police brutality against persons of a particular race, is this about systemic injustice, systemic racism within an important public institution? And on it goes. Now, that's not to say that that connection is illegitimate. What it is trying to say is that when the media covers stories like this, it tends to be plugged into something much larger than itself in order to attract, in order to secure the largest public interest available.
Now, and often what it's grasping for is not really reducible to fact.
That's right. That's right.
So it can only really exist at the level of inference or theorizing, even if you find it incredibly persuasive. It's not a fact in the same way as a rock is a fact, right? It's
although one of the things that Pierre Bourdieu pointed out in his wonderful book on television from 1977 is that one of the jobs of TV talking heads is to produce and to appeal to so-called social facts that then circulate among us as something that highly resembles a fact, a kind of shorthand that you can then refer to easily that then has that kind of broader public acceptance.
But broadly speaking, and I mean, we could critique this forever, but broadly speaking, what they're actually offering as factual or quasi-factual are interpretations.
Yes, that's right. Now, here's the reason I'm bringing it up. I didn't mean to raise that simply critically. I think there are things about that that can be criticized. But one of the things that I believe the media is doing there, and this is where I think it's proper to speak about the moral dimension of the media's activity. The media holds up something, an experience, an encounter that is meant to produce a kind of recognition among and of other people who have gone through the same thing. So I don't think, and this is what we meant before, I think we talked about the prosecution of a particular cause or capital J justice. This is an attempt to hold up something not as one unfortunate thing that happened to one person, but something that so many people then see themselves, their own experience, their own tragedy, their own experience of injustice reflected in. There's something in that that I think is important, especially when you then reflect on, say, the experiences of what's sometimes called testimonial injustice that are experienced by those who have, for instance, brought allegations of sexual violence or rape in the past, only not to have their testimony believed, or for the rules of evidence not to give their accounts the weight that it deserves. This is one of the things I think that was so impressive about Justice Lee's judgment, is his judgment reflected so much of the learnings that have taken place in society over the last 10 years. So I think if we acknowledge that this is what the law does, and the law does quite peculiarly, This is what the media does, and the moral dimension to it, in the sense of the recognition that it gives to others who have experienced something similar and who are craving that recognition. There's something there, too, that goes beyond mere fact-finding, that goes beyond mere truth-telling.
Mm, very much so. I mean, I think that tension that you raise of the particular and the general, that's at the heart of this whole conversation. And a lot of the dilemmas that spring from all these cases that we're talking about. The law deals with this in a really interesting way where, yes, it deals with the particular. And I think that's where some of the problems with the law lie. We have this adversarial system. It only can decide, courts can only decide the cases that come before it. So there might be a high court that we have at the moment that thinks there's an aspect of constitutional law that we really want to change because there's been dramatic misinterpretations and injustice happening because of these misinterpretations. But the High Court can't do anything about that unless there happens to be a case in front of it. And then when a particular case comes up, the court will decide on the very particular facts. But that then becomes a precedent, you know, particularly if we're talking about a higher court. So it is generalized in a way that becomes applicable and becomes law. And that whole process is fascinating. So the part of the judgment that becomes law is the ratio decidendi. So that is the reasoning of the court, the principles they applied, not the other stuff, not where they were just, you know, making some comment in passing. But in some cases, you'll have five different judgments. You'll have a minority judgment. You'll have two minority judgments. Sometimes it can be really difficult to identify what the ratio of the case is and what the law of that case is. And there's some conjecture about it. So, look, I think that tension that you raise about particular and general is a real one. And I think it's the way Justice Lee handled it was fantastic because he managed to get to the particulars of that case, considering the evidence in a really fair and forensic way. But the law also has some issues with then taking what is before it and then working that into the legal system and into precedent.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, you know, I should probably leave this for more experienced, better lawyers than me to say, but since I'm the only one here, well, no, I'm not, clearly not the only one, but you know what I mean. It's unlikely, I would have thought, that something legally groundbreaking emerged from this particular judgment. This was a judgment that was a fairly straightforward application of the law. The interesting bit was the application of the law to the facts rather than the development of the law itself. Okay. Right. And you're right to say there are these elements of precedent and so on. They're fairly confined. Lawyers spend a lot of time arguing over exactly what is binding, what isn't. Okay, sure. But I think what's interesting for our purposes is that what the law won't do. So what the concern of media, and by the way, we spent too much time talking about media, I think, in a context where social media and the public is a big part of this conversation, and in some ways superseded the role of the media in these sorts of situations. But what the public / media / social media is trying to do is take a case and make it fit its broader narrative.
That's right.
What the courts are trying to do is ignore the narrative and apply pre-existing legal principles to the facts of the case. So it's attentive to those things that simply don't fit within the narrative. That's where I think this becomes really interesting, because it's actually really quite rare, I would say, for a case to come along that is a holus bolus, full confirmation of a particular narrative. Usually there is some kind of complicating factor, something that distinguishes it. I'm not going to, you know, grind this out in the case of O.J. Simpson or Lerman, but you could easily imagine, it wouldn't be hard for me to say, right, well, this is the prevailing narrative that's coming out about police violence or about sexual assault or whatever. And here are all the things where you would have to, paying very close attention to the fact of this case, say, yeah, but did you notice this? And did you notice that? And did you notice that finding? And this isn't really a case of that because of X, Y, Z, right? You can do that forever. And I think this is the problem with taking a particular case as representative, making a particular case the basis on which, or the platform for the prosecution of a politics or a narrative, rather than an aggregation of cases. The problem is an aggregation of cases doesn't really work in a media setting because media likes a singular story from which you can extrapolate. You spoke, Sasha, about the relationship to truth. The thing with that process is not really one of truth in any precise sense. it's a process of inference, of interpretation. You'd need a perhaps drier, more uninteresting, perhaps, dare I say it, even more academic approach to try to establish the truth of these propositions. But the media doesn't really have the time for that. And the audience, I don't think, has the sustained interest for that, except in very rare cases.
Mm. Well, right on that point, one of my favourite lines was Justice Lee saying, talking about the media codes and so on, I don't think reporting honestly is that complicated, is it? It's a bit like it's not complicated not shoplifting from Woolworths. And there was some back and forth with TENS Council. I don't know about that. I think truth is elusive. You know, it can be elusive for journalists, it can be elusive for the law, just like justice can be elusive sometimes. And we have all these codes that I mentioned. The one most commonly cited is the one cited in court, the MEAA Journalist Code of Ethics. You know, it's very clear. It's quite succinct. I quite like the provisions there. It's commitment. It prescribes commitments to respect and fairness and honesty. But still, you know, journalists have these competing considerations. And, okay, maybe if honesty is clear, being honesty, maybe that's a reasonably clear prescription. But what about the prescription to be impartial? That's a tricky one. You know, the codes, even when they're simply expressed, are difficult.
Yeah. And even honesty, like at what point have you honestly disclosed all of the facts? Because you can never fully, you can't disclose every fact. That for starters, we'd never agree on what all the relevant facts are.
Indeed.
So even the idea of the establishment of truth, courts don't establish truth. What they establish is a finding of fact to a relevant standard on the basis of evidence.
Mm.
And here, this is not a criticism of any, this is just a statement of the way that judgments and courts work. When a judge says, I find that X happened, they're not making a statement of truth as though God were making this proclamation. They're making a finding based on evidence, and they will use phrases like, I am satisfied that X was established to the relevant standard, etc. And if they're wrong about that, there might be an appeal and so on and so forth. But all of these things have elements of doubt built into them because we as human beings are in an environment of doubt. So all we can do is establish things to a standard that means justice has been done. And I think maybe that's the kind of calculation that journalism and the public could use as well. It might be different tests, it might be different standards, but that sort of idea, it's like, I can't establish this as absolute, but I can say that we have a sufficient level of confidence to be able to declare X, Y, Z.
And just to bring this full circle, even though there is a form of ethics that is particular to the law, what you both have been discussing is, I think, a clear demonstration of why the commitments that are at the center of the law, the approach to, say, epistemic humility, the approach to upholding the dignity of the accuser, the dignity of the accused, the attention to particularity, these are all things, I think, even though they are expressions of a form of ethics, an understanding of ethical commitment that is particular to the law, these have a great deal to tell, to say, to, say, journalism, to moral deliberation, to political agitation and advocacy more generally. So even though they are inherent, I mean, I would even like to say that these particular commitments of the law, they remind me very, very closely of particular commitments that are inherent to certain forms of moral philosophy that abjure the generality in favor of minute attentiveness to the dignity of particularities.
Yeah, there's a strong relationship between them. We are out of time, I'm afraid. That is both a particular observation and a general observation about the nature of time and the length of this show. That is a restriction that we bear every week. Sasha, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. We could have kept going forever. Sasha, well, maybe not forever. You know what I mean. Sasha Bulatoris is a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Law at UTS, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.